From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll look at the push to hold a constitutional convention and how it could reshape the founding document of our nation. Then we'll learn how hunters can help prevent the spread of highly pathogenic avian flu in Wisconsin.
We are seeing some wild birds be infected. So that includes waterfowl, and then some of the species that are known to like consume waterfowl, like we've had eagles that have tested positive, some other raptor species that have tested positive.
We'll learn about the Cine Latino Film Festival, plus explore our local cover band scene and the role they play for audiences in the Milwaukee festival market.
You know, now that I'm playing in a cover band, tribute band, it's the joy of playing, right? It's the joy of interacting with an audience.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. Republicans and conservative activists in Wisconsin are part of a growing group of politicians calling for a new constitutional convention, which could fundamentally reshape the U.S. Constitution. The movement has been quietly growing for more than a decade and could allow a group of politicians to completely rewrite our founding document. A new book called The Constitution in Jeopardy outlines the motives of this movement and the potential ramifications of such a convention. It's authored by former U.S. Senator from Wisconsin Russ Feingold, along with Peter Prindeville, a non-resident fellow at the Stanford Constitutional Law Center. They join me now to talk about this. Peter, Russ, thank you both so much for being here on Lake Effect.
It's good to be on.
Thanks for having us.
So I think this is a concept that people who are in politics have certainly heard of, that's been kind of swimming around for a while now. But how do you explain this concept of a convention that could amend and ultimately alter the Constitution to people who have really never heard of this?
Well, nobody should feel bad that they haven't heard of it, because I certainly didn't know much about it a few years ago, and neither did Peter. We began studying it when I was teaching and Peter was my student at Stanford Law School. And look, it's pretty straightforward, even though most people don't know about it. Under Article 5 of the Constitution, that's the way we amend the Constitution. There's two ways to do it. One is if a two-thirds of both houses of the House and the Senate vote for a constitutional amendment, and then three-fourths of the states approve it, it goes in the Constitution. And that's what's always been done whenever we've amended the Constitution. But at the same time, they put in another provision, and that was for a possible convention. If two-thirds of the states, that is 34 states right now, apply for a convention, the Congress is obligated to call for a convention where we believe they can consider essentially anything to change the Constitution. So those are the two mechanisms. It's just that the second one's never happened before.
As you say, this is a situation in which they could possibly consider anything. We'll get back to that in just a moment. But how did this movement really begin how did this specific movement really begin?
The movement for a convention held under Article 5 really finds its birth in the 60s with the Warren Court's apportionment rulings. And Senator Dirksen from Illinois started an effort that ultimately fizzled. It was resurrected in the 80s, a movement for a balanced budget amendment, which likewise failed. And then during President Obama's first term, the movement really found new life and really quite radically expanded its goals. And so we can trace this longer history back to the 60s, but it really found its newfound momentum during the Obama administration.
As you say, the impetus for this convention has taken a few forms, but there are a myriad of goals now that are a part of this. What are those? What are people hoping to look at if they are able to hold this kind of convention?
Well, as we said, they could do anything, and that's something that causes people to be very concerned. But we don't have to really guess at what they're trying to do. They have held mock conventions where they've debated very seriously for several days what they want to do. And they held one in Williamsburg in 2016, and they voted by a state-by-state basis, which really skews the results, one vote per state. But they voted for an amendment that would severely curtail the power of the federal government, of the Congress, for example, to deal with the COVID crisis or pass a serious transportation legislation. They voted for an amendment that would limit federal agencies, for example, the ability of the Environmental Protection Agency to act on climate change or clean water. They passed an amendment that would eliminate the income tax, make it impossible to have a national income tax. And probably their favorite is they want it to be so that 30 states could override, eliminate, nullify any federal congressional law or any regulation. So basically taking us back to before the Constitution to something more like what was called the Articles of Confederation, which miserably failed to allow us to run this country.
What are the dangers of something like that happening? You mentioned this is something, of course, that we have tried before. Why didn't it work? And why do you believe it won't work now?
Well, there are many concerns about how a convention would actually work, practically speaking and legally. These were concerns raised in the 60s when Senator Dirksen was leading the movement, again in the 80s, and again are being raised today. The most important one of these is whether or not the convention's topics can actually be limited. We have this fascinating exchange in the book between Senator Proxmire of Wisconsin and Senator Dirksen of Illinois, in which even Senator Dirksen believed that the convention couldn't be limited. So that's a trouble in and of itself. It would be a Pandora's box of reforms being drafted. But the other concern is who's actually doing the drafting, who would be there. You know, in law, the most powerful person is the person that holds the pen. And so it's important to think about who would actually be delegates at such a convention. The Constitution provides no guidance, and in that void has rushed new theories about who should be delegates. And the contemporary effort on the right has divined, really from thin air, new theories about how the convention works. And prime of that is that the state legislatures would choose who goes, not the people. And they've completely reframed Article 5 as a convening of the states, not of the people, which is it's a completely ahistorical. It has almost no grounding in our constitutional history, and most definitely not in the lived experience of Article 5.
So essentially, state legislatures like Wisconsin's, which is heavily gerrymandered, would be deciding who is going to the convention.
That's what they claim. That's not a settled matter of law by any means. Yet part of our concern is that were this convening called and this theory was put forward, there would be no legal mechanism by which to counter the theory. And so you might have a true constitutional crisis where this current effort, which is lavishly funded by far-right interests who would put forth one theory, and others who have studied this issue intently, would note that the theory has no legal basis, but that there is no real mechanism with which to counter it. And so that's a real concern. And such a crisis could pose a real trouble for our body politic.
And Joy, you really said it all. Do we really want gerrymandered legislatures to rewrite our Constitution? That's what this is about.
I think people who pay attention to politics pretty closely will probably recognize this idea of a constitutional convention coming up for at least the last decade, you know, intermittently. But as you say, it has been hushed. What is the motivation for keeping this kind of under the radar?
Well, this is a very big deal to try to undo the Constitution. And when people like you are kind enough to let us explain it to people, they get pretty worried. And they realize that you can't just sit back and say, well, they probably won't be able to do it, or maybe they won't do anything bad, or maybe you won't get 3/4 of the states. They have a tremendous amount of funding, as Peter said, and they want to get a huge advantage and head start in this thing. And so to keep it quiet is in their interest. Taking the lid off of it and letting every American know what's being attempted is in the interest of most Americans. That's why we wrote the book, because people need to know what they're doing, even though they want to keep it quiet.
There's a great anecdote that we discuss in the book from the ballots budget amendment era, where a movement ultimately fizzled because of the legitimate concerns about an Article 5 convention. And one of the leaders of the movement had said he was sad because they had tried to convince state legislators that the applications were just as meaningful as a resolution endorsing apple pie. And when the lid came off and people realized the true power of this convening and the real concerns, the legitimate legal concerns, that it got a lot harder to get the applications passed because people were examining them with more scrutiny. And so our goal here is to issue a warning to concerned citizens about this effort and encourage concerned citizens and concerned state legislators to examine this effort very closely and to examine it with a cool head.
I think that gets to really a central point of this conversation and something that I think I've actually had conversations about the movement to hold a constitutional convention, and something that legal experts have consistently said is, well, there's a movement to make it happen, but it's very unlikely. How close is this to becoming a reality? They need 3/4 of the states. How many do they have right now?
Well, we devote a whole chapter to what we call the archaics, which is the problem of people on the left, progressives, academics, the media, tending to discount things that they don't think will happen. It's sort of a overconfidence, a tendency to not want to deal with things. And, you know, for example, people didn't take seriously the movement on the right to cause the idea of a right to bear arms to provide an individual right to bear arms until it was too late. And so, look, we don't say that they're one state away from or anything like that from having enough applications, but the counting mechanism is unclear. There are no rules about it. So there's actually a resolution having been filed in the House of Representatives by a conservative Texas congressman saying that they already have enough. And so if they get the Congress goes Republican in January, they could just call a convention. And there's really no way to stop them, even though Peter and I seriously question the way in which they count these petitions or applications. We think it's a form of phony math.
Who ultimately would make that decision? If you believe it's phony math, but the other side, of course, is saying we have enough people, who decides that?
Well, it's Congress. The Constitution makes very clear that Congress's only role in regard to an Article 5 convention is to call the convening. They have no power to regulate the convening, but they can call it. And in the text of the Constitution, it's clear that this is a ministerial act, meaning Congress has no discretion about it. If the threshold's been met, they have to do it. But ultimately, we argue in the book that it's a political action. Because there are no rules about how one counts these applications, it's quite possible that what today would be considered very fringe theories that have very little legal basis about how to count the over 400 applications that have been submitted since 1789 might actually, you know, come to the floor. And so, you know, we've seen other examples in modern life about where Congress adopts what might be considered to be very extreme positions. Look at the almost a quarter of Congress that refused to certify that President Biden, in fact, had won the presidential election. And so we're concerned about this. It's also important to note that a lawsuit has been filed, I believe, in the Southern District of Texas, claiming that the threshold has likewise been satisfied and that a court should order the Congress to do it. And we would dispute the court's ability to do that. But nonetheless, the issue is coming to the fore.
So we have someone in Congress who is saying, we have the numbers, we have enough people to do this. And then Congress then also would be the one to call it. It sounds to me like, I don't want to say that there's no oversight, but that both the people proposing and the people overseeing it are the same people.
It is the same people. And there's going to be enormous pressure on them. Peter said it exactly right. It's not like they see these applications and go, well, this might be a good idea to have a convention or not have a good idea to have a convention. They have to do it. If they believe that they want to have a convention, they're obligated to do it. And it's not an up or down sort of decision about whether it's a good idea. It's just that they should do it. So that's the argument they're going to make. They're going to say, you know, by using phony approach, that they have enough of these applications. And they're going to say, look, it's time to do it. And I have a feeling that at least the House of Representatives, if it changes in its leadership, in its majority, will do exactly that.
So to bring back home, what has this movement looked like here in Wisconsin? What are people proposing who are part of the Constitutional Convention proponents here in the state?
It's clear that they're part of the same convention of the states movement. This gerrymandered legislature here in Wisconsin has approved just about every conservative application. And I don't need to guess because my wife and my brother-in-law went down and attended one of these meetings that they had at the Capitol. It wasn't a Wisconsin-based group. I mean, there were Wisconsin people there, but it was the national leaders of this. Rick Santorum, the former senator, Mark Meckler, and others, they showed up and they showed that this is a nationally heavily funded by very wealthy people movement. And those who run the state legislature are very tied in with ALEC, the state conservative state legislative organization. Peter, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think they've ever turned them down in the Wisconsin legislature.
Well, what's very clear is that, you know, Wisconsin has been on the cutting edge of these applications. They've passed multiple, the legislature. And it's important to note that the governor has no role in this. It's not like normal acts of the legislature that have to be signed by the governor. It's just the legislature. So the ills of gerrymandering, partisan gerrymandering, which are so evident in Wisconsin, show how troubling this movement is because you have a legislature that is overwhelmingly controlled by one party, even in a state where statewide races are won by the other party, supposedly claiming to speak for the people in passing these applications to Congress for an Article 5 convention. And so I think Wisconsin, to answer your question, Joy, it's the perfect example, both of the contemporary state of play regarding this convention issue, but also what we argue in the book are the real problems with Article 5. You know, the Constitution speaks in the name of the people, and it makes the bold claim that was so central to the Revolution that the people constitute their government and the people are empowered to change that government. Well, I think if you look at the actions in Wisconsin under Article 5, I think it becomes a little troubling to accept the claim that the people are really acting on constitutional matters in Wisconsin right now.
All right. Well, Peter, Russ, thank you both so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you. It was great. Enjoyed it.
Well, thanks so much, Joy.
Russ Feingold is a former U.S. Senator from Wisconsin, and he's currently president of the American Constitution Society. Peter Prindeville is a non-resident fellow at the Stanford Constitutional Law Center. Together, they wrote the book, The Constitution in Jeopardy. It's waterfowl hunting season in Wisconsin, and duck hunting enthusiasts are excitedly taking to the water. But the Wisconsin DNR is asking them to be careful of highly pathogenic avian flu. The virus has been causing illness and death among wild and domestic birds throughout the Midwest. While the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says the current strain doesn't present an immediate public health concern, the Wisconsin DNR state wildlife veterinarian Lindsay Long is advising hunters to take simple precautions when harvesting and handling wild birds. Long joins WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Bentz to share what's known about the avian flu in Wisconsin and how the DNR is monitoring the situation.
Currently, there is evidence that this highly pathogenic avian influenza that we identified this spring is still circulating in mostly waterfowl populations. So that's a little bit different than it's been in the past. Previously, we normally see it decline significantly over the summers, and we may not see it in the fall. So that's one of the reasons why we just wanted people to be aware.
In Wisconsin, the first evidence this time around was in Jefferson County, isn't that correct? And previous to that, it had occurred in, what, 2015?
It's slightly different, yeah. There's slightly different strains, but the last time we had any high path avian influenza detections in the state was in 2015, and that was in domestic birds. So the first domestic bird, again, was this spring, but we've also identified it, this highly pathogenic avian influenza circulating in wild, specifically mostly waterfowl.
I want to go to the precautions, but what is the monitoring that the DNR is currently carrying out?
Well, so we partner with a lot of state and federal agencies. So right now, USDA Wildlife Services is doing some of their they're looking at specific watershed units and doing some outreach and doing some surveillance on their harvested birds. And then we're doing our investigative arm, our mortality investigation. So if people are noticing five or more sick or dead waterfowl in an area, they can reach out to us.
So that's the basis of the monitoring. The DNR is relying on members of the public observing this and letting them know.
For morbidity and mortality investigations, because we can't be sure that it's the circulating HPAI, correct? So for the national surveillance effort to see how this virus might be moving right now, we partner with our USDA Wildlife Services partners, and they coordinate across all the flyways.
Got it. So right now, what the concern is that not only is there hunting, this is being found in waterfowl, but there's also migration going on. Does that play into birds, waterfowl being more susceptible?
Well, waterfowl in general carry avian influenza viruses, and most commonly in their intestinal tract. So normally we don't necessarily see any disease in waterfowl because they're what we call low path, meaning that they don't cause waterfowl to get sick, and the low path designation is really identified with it doesn't really cause severe disease in like domestic birds. With this particular strain of high path avian influenza, we are seeing some wild birds be infected. So that includes waterfowl. And then some of the species that are known to like consume waterfowl, like we've had eagles that have tested positive, some other raptor species that have tested positive and gotten sick from this virus. So that's kind of where we keep our specific monitoring on. And, you know, it's those species that tend to be either naturally carry these avian influenza viruses, but this one is causing them disease, or, and then also some of the raptor species that consume them.
It is normally present in the gut of the birds, but that this outbreak of illness and death is what is raising the concern.
Right. It's a different strain. So there's just like with people, how the influenza vaccine has to change every year because it has a different component. It's the influenza virus is made up differently, and they try and predict which ones are going to be the most prevalent that year. It's the same with this. We have multiple avian influenza viruses, like multiple strains out there, and it all depends on these proteins on the outer surface of the virus about how it interacts. And this one just seems to cause more disease in wild birds than we've seen other influenza viruses in the past.
So right now we're mm-hmm. in the woodcock and in some areas in the duck hunting season. So are these normal precautions that one would ask hunters to adhere to?
No, I think these are general precautions that are always good to follow. When you are harvesting wildlife, you're a lot of times handling animals that you don't have a history on. And you're also a lot of times handling internal organs and things, right, that you don't normally handle when you purchase things from the grocery store. And that's where a lot of pathogens and things typically are, just, you know, regular ones that may not cause illness even for the birds, but like salmonellas and things like that may cause disease for us. So this is just, it's good precautions to keep in your mind whenever you're working or harvesting wild or domestic animals.
Are there any of the precautions in particular that you see are most important to highlight, or really the whole list of them?
Well, I think what's important for people to remember especially is we connected to the USDA precautions. People who might have domestic birds at home, our partners at DATCAP also have some biosecurity measures up for people who have birds at home, making sure that they're not wearing the same boots, making sure that they wash hands, that they're cleaning equipment, and not using similar things or in areas where they might pass the virus on to domestic birds on their premise, I think is really important to stress for people who might have like backyard chickens and things like that. The other things that are just always good to have, like cooking to a temperature of 165, because that's known to kill most foodborne illnesses. Those kinds of things are just also good measures that are, I think, are good to hit on.
Going back to that cooking to a temperature of 165 mm-hmm. degrees Fahrenheit kills this particular virus. Does that mean if a hunter harvests waterfowl that happens to have the virus, that it would be okay to eat that waterfowl?
Yep. And while the CDC says this is low risk to people, we also just want people to be aware, and so that they take precautions not to overexpose themselves.
So I've also read, I believe, that waterfowl are more susceptible than other game birds to this virus. Is that correct? And why is that the case?
I don't know if I'd say they're more susceptible, but they come into contact more regularly with this virus. So the way to look at it is, like, the avian influenza viruses are kind of adapted to waterfowl. So that's why we find them most readily in those species. Especially during migratory seasons, you have a number of waterfowl moving through areas, and they move through these wetland areas where there's mud and muck and things like that too, where the virus might also be able to maintain itself outside of these animals. So because of the densities, because of the fact that they normally carry avian influenza viruses, like ones that aren't high pathogenic, it just puts them in more contact with the virus.
So
it doesn't mean other birds aren't susceptible. It just means that they tend to have more contact, and the virus is kind of adapted to be carried by these animals.
Got it.
By these specific birds.
There was a recent USDA briefing. Their focus was its impact on domestic poultry.
Mm-hmm. It definitely moves with wild birds. A lot of these viruses, though, you know, like the high path, the way that strains develop is because they're introduced into domestic poultry, then they reassort, and then they get reintroduced in the wild. So it's kind of a, that's why we try and take precautions biosecurity-wise both ways, because it's that reassortment that tend to cause problems.
In summary, what is the key message that you want to relate to people who are enjoying the waterfowl season and how they can both enjoy and be safe and also be helpful to the environment?
I think the big takeaways are we just want people to be aware that this virus is still circulating, that they should follow these good precautionary measures, including making sure not to handle or eat sick game is always one of those, wearing gloves and disinfecting their hands after they're through handling game and cleaning their equipment. And then again, making sure to wash all of those, like your boots and pants and everything, and making sure that you are following good biosecurity measures at home if you do have backyard birds, I think is a good way to try and keep those viruses from intermixing and causing problems domestically, and also from introducing things into wild populations. And so letting us know if they're seeing mortality events, especially if they're seeing more than 5 dead or migratory water birds, that's also important.
Lindsay Long is the state wildlife veterinarian for the Wisconsin DNR, and she spoke with WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz. Coming up, we'll learn more about cover bands. Love them or hate them, they're a huge part of celebrations here in Milwaukee. In about 10 minutes, we'll learn all about the community and what they mean to Milwaukee's music scene. But first, we'll look at this year's Cine Latino Film Festival, which is returning to Marcus Theater screens today. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. The Cine Latino Film Festival is returning to screens today. From today through October 9th, Marcus Theaters will hold screenings of over 15 movies to celebrate Hispanic-directed, written, and focused films in celebration of Hispanic Heritage Month. The festival is hosted by Marcus Theaters, along with Advocate Aurora Health. Rolando Rodriguez is senior advisor of Marcus Theaters, and he was recently the chairman and CEO of the company. He chats with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang about the Cine Latino Film Festival.
Rolando, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect. I really appreciate you being here today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you so much, Mallory.
Rolando, Cine Latino is returning after a two-year pandemic-related hiatus to present 15 films focusing on Hispanic-directed, written, and focused films. What exactly is Cine Latino, and why was this programming started at Marcus Theaters?
Look, Cine Latino is about education, frankly. It's about educating the general audiences, so it's not just the Hispanic audience. It's a little bit about the Hispanic culture. And so when we started this initially, and it still remains the goals behind it, is to ensure that we provide information about the fastest growing population base in Wisconsin and in Milwaukee, and give them a little taste about the Hispanic culture, by the way, which happens to fall in Hispanic Heritage Month. And then a lot of the proceeds from this actually go to support Hispanic causes in both education as well as healthcare.
Very cool. And this programming, Cine Latino, started 4 years ago. Why was this important to Marcus Theaters to start this?
You know, it's important because when you think about the Hispanic and all diverse audiences, by the way, which are becoming a significant portion of the entertainment component, in particular in movies, you see that about 25 to 30% of the audiences that are attending movies right now happen to be Hispanic Latino. So that becomes a very important portion of our consumer base. And I think it's important both from, as you look at the entire United States, the growth of the population base happens to be Hispanic for the most part in large percentiles. In fact, 30% of the alpha, the youngest generation, will be Hispanic Latinos. So think about that for the future workforce and obviously consumerism. So from our perspective, we felt it was good to start educating our community about the Hispanic. The fact that I happen to be Hispanic and Latino, there was an encouragement from me to help educate, you know, the marketplace about it. So I'm very proud of our organization launching this program and also benefiting, you know, these great causes in education as well as healthcare in the community.
Yeah, and you just had mentioned that a portion of Cine Latino's festival proceeds will be going to some local initiatives. What are those initiatives and why was that a component to this festival?
Well, it was important because we feel that in many of these causes, I also happen to be the chairman of the Hispanic Collaborative. And what we're starting to see is that our community continues to suffer in different portions. In other words, workforce development, education, healthcare. And so we feel that it's important to call that out, number one. And number two, obviously be part of the solution. And being part of the solution is helping to educate in the marketplace that this is happening. And number two, ideally, as we raise funds through this festival, that this festival is intended to obviously give back to that community and ensure that we're actually helping them with some of the challenges that they're having financially. So those causes, again, very focused in education. So having, you know, providing scholarships for kids to continue in their college education, that's very important, I think, to our community. And second of all, we work very closely with Advocate Aurora, who has been our, you know, founding sponsor on this. Well, I can't tell you and say enough good things about them, that they also have a cancer Hispanic clinic that's targeted specifically to help Hispanics.
Really cool local collaboration there. And with Cine Latino, of course, it's a film festival. There's going to be movies showing at across Marcus Theaters in the Milwaukee area. What movies will be shown throughout the film festival and where can audiences find them?
Well, first of all, we're about fun and we're about having fun while we're helping to educate. So coming to the movies, believe me, it's wonderful. And I encourage all of you to come out. We have 15 films. It'll be the Renaissance Theater, the South Shore Theater, the Majestic of Brookfield, and our movie Tavern of Brookfield as well. And we have a great lineup. I mean, we got films that go back nostalgic, like Selena and La Bamba, which are going to be a lot of fun. And then we have new movies like Lao Lao Crocodile that'll be obviously in Spanish. Just about all these titles will be either in Spanish or Spanish subtitles, so or English subtitles. So please know that this is for the entire community to obviously endure. Father of the Bride, a must-see in the Spanish version with Andy Garcia and Gloria Estefan. And by the way, one of my favorites that I just saw, The Last Out, which happens to be from my native country of Cuba, and it's about baseball players on how they're trying to get into the major leagues and what it takes to do that. So that was a very interesting movie that I would encourage all of you. But look, we got Half Brothers, Minions, Encanto, Cuando Sea Joven, Spirit, you know, Receta No Incluida. There's a lot of great films here. So the festival's going to be October 5th through October 9th. Please come out and see us.
So, Rolando, just on a personal note, too, we're talking right as you're about to retire as the head of Marcus Theaters, and you'll be transitioning into a new role. And you've been working in the industry of movie theaters for a very long time, for over 30 years now. And while reflecting on your time, your own time, and reflecting on programs such as Cine Latino, how can movie theaters continue celebrating diversity and representation of their audiences outside of Hispanic Heritage Month, outside of any other of the heritage months throughout the calendar year?
Listen, I'm still going to continue being the chairman of the National Association of Theater Owners. They just voted me back in last week, all the way through October 2023. So part of my mission and part of my passion and actually aspirations within our community is that right now we only have about 4% of the artistic community that's represented in Hollywood. That's not good. And that's in the Hispanic. And by the way, not much better for women and not much better for African Americans and not much better for Asians. So we have a tremendous amount of work ahead of us. And it's where I'm actually going to be spending a lot of time and continuing these efforts to ensure that we have a lot more representation. Because look, we're about storytelling in our industry. And what a better way to tell stories and unite people in inclusion, and what I would call inclusion. People focus on DE&I. I focus on the inclusion part. And if we have that inclusion in that storytelling, I think we're going to be a lot more successful in bringing our communities together and understanding the differences about each other.
Well, Rolando, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect. I really appreciate you being here today.
Well, thank you so much, Mallory, and thank you for doing this. And I encourage all of you to come out and see us at Cine Latino October 5th through October 9th. Thank you.
Rolando Rodriguez is senior advisor of Marcus Theaters. And until recently, he was the chairman and CEO of the company. He joined Lake Effect's Mallory Chang to talk about the Cine Latino Film Festival, which can be seen now at Marcus Theaters through October 9th. You can find more information at WUWM.com. And did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? If you'd like to take us on the go or hear any of the segments on the show, search for Lake Effect in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. You can also follow WUWM on Instagram, where you'll find videos and pictures from news stories and Lake Effect interviews. Coming up, we'll learn about the local cover band community here in Milwaukee. That's next on Lake Effect, on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Cover bands, no matter your opinions of them, there's no denying they're a significant presence in the Milwaukee area. Whether it's at the State Fair, church festivals, or even Summerfest, they pay tribute to artists by mimicking the original songs as accurately as possible, or through their own reinterpretations. Brian Wooldridge is the bassist and leader of the band Look Sharp, a local Joe Jackson tribute band. He joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to share how he entered the world after being in his own original band and what he's learned about the cover band community.
So how long have you been a part of the local cover band scene here in Milwaukee?
Well, cover band, I'm pretty new to it. I was in the original scene for 20 plus years. It's cover band about 4 years, but two of them, those it was COVID, so it doesn't really count.
So as a recent member of the cover band scene, I'm curious, what were your impressions of cover bands before you joined one?
Well, as a younger man, I was probably a snob about certain things in music, and that still carries over once in a while, and I try to remind myself to let it go. There's always, oh, that's cheesy. Oh, you know, you can't write your own songs. You can't make it happen as an original. But I've learned to respect a lot of the cover band players because they're really good players. You know, now that I'm playing in a cover band, tribute band, it's like, it's the joy of playing, right? It's the joy of interacting with an audience. Those are the key elements. And it's a great outlet for people who can really play an instrument.
So how did you come to be in this world? You are a bassist and leader of the band Look Sharp, which is a Joe Jackson cover band. So what led you to entering this world?
Well, the Wolters Brothers got put on the shelf due to life. And my brother lives in Minneapolis, and we had some health issues. We were just getting older. And so we put that on the shelf. And I was listening to Look Sharp by Joe Jackson. And I thought, man, these songs are great. The bass playing is a lot of fun. It's, Graham Mabey, the bass player from the Joe Jackson band, is just amazing. I would love to play these bass parts. So I had that in my head for years. And then once the Wolters Brothers were done, I was at a squeeze show at the Pabst, and I ran into Tom Schaefer, who I knew 20 years ago as the lead singer for a cover band called the Numb Jitters. They were a ska cover band. And I hadn't seen him for 20 years. And we ran into each other in the lobby and recognized each other and got talking. And I said, hey, I got this idea of doing a Joe Jackson Look Sharp tribute band. And he's like, I'm in. And within a week, we had a band together. And that was right before COVID. We played one show, COVID hit. And now we're picking it back up.
So given that you just started entering the cover band scene, COVID happens, you're picking it back up again. What have you observed about the community of cover bands in the region? Would you say it leans heavily towards a genre, say like 80s rock, or any predominant genre or type of styles that you've noticed?
Yeah, well, the ones that I'm close to are like Radio and the Five Card Studs, which I think are pretty popular. That's a generational thing too. But, you know, I lean toward the 80s and 90s rock stuff. But we made a decision not to be a 80s cover band because we felt that was pretty covered in the city. And we decided to do a tribute thing. And when we play the album, Look Sharp, front to back, in order. Now, we're kind of reconsidering that now because it's like, it kind of puts you in, it, you have a niche. But it doesn't allow you to play out that much because people might not want to hear the same album, you know, exactly the way it was. So we're trying to figure that out.
So I've grown up in Milwaukee, and while I can't attest to any place else, it does seem like cover and tribute bands have a pretty good stronghold and scene here, like especially the festival circuit, any church festival, any park festival or concert night or something, there is usually always some cover band thrown into the mix. So how do cover bands feed the Milwaukee festival circuit? Just how do you see our relationship to cover bands here?
Well, good question. I talked to Scott Zeal from Summerfest and kind of picked his brain about, you know, how they, you know, they book a lot of cover bands, but they also try not to overdo it. And, you know, they also want to, you know, have the original bands play too. And so they say, you know, they usually book like a tribute band if there seems to be like a need, like they do this band called Hotel California. Of course, they're a tribute band to the Eagles. You know, there's like a Rush band that's playing the Pabst, doing 2112 and that kind of stuff. But yeah, it's a weird thing. With the church things, you seem like it's always like the 50s and 60s, and now it's the 80s and 90s, you know, and maybe it'll be, I don't know, Beyonce in a couple of years.
With cover bands, audiences will inherently know what they're about, right? Just by the nature of this is the genre, this is the person we're a tribute to. So I imagine being part of the cover band makes it a challenge to play in a live audience, in that since audiences already are familiar with the songs, there needs to be a strong stage presence. So what do you think is most important to do in order to create a fun atmosphere?
Well, take the Five Card Studs. I think they did a really good job of having kind of characters that they developed for the each player. And Chris, the lead singer at the time, he's moved on, but you know, he was very energetic and very personable and a great front man. And I think probably the vocals are the main thing. I mean, having the lead guitar riff or whatever from a song is always important, but the vocals are usually the main thing. Like with Look Sharp, it's very energetic, kind of punk pop. So all the guys in the band are in their 50s, you know, and bringing a live show together of songs that were recorded when the guys that did it, you know, were in their 20s, brings its challenge. But we think we've almost met the energy level. And so I think energy level and confidence is the key, you know, to pull off a cover band or a tribute band.
What other kind of things have you discovered in this learning curve?
One of the things that, you know, we're doing is that with Joe Jackson, he was a keyboard player. And we actually don't have a keyboardist in the band. And so we are converting some of the songs that are keyboard heavy and rewriting them and kind of rearranging them into guitar songs. And that's been a fun thing and a challenge.
Something you said earlier about listening to, you know, Joe Jackson and listening to the bass lines and knowing like this would be fun to play. That kind of reminded me of back, say, if people grew up having to take an instrument in school. It's fun because here you have the bass line set already. Here's the sheet music of something that already existed, and you're honing your skills to do this. So having gone from the world of original music and trying to do that yourself to now cover bands, is this kind of just a good way to keep that skill set up but have a broader reach? How do you view it in just your personal relationship to music and wanting to keep your skill set up to date?
Yeah, it's a challenge. It's a lot of fun to keep the skills up and learn those old bass parts. And actually what was really cool is recently Joe Jackson and, you know, with the original bass player were playing at the Patch recently, last May. And I got to go see them and actually meet the bass player, Graham Mabey, afterwards for a brief second, and just told them that we were doing a tribute band to their first album, and they thought that was really cool. But yeah, it's a great way to keep your chops up, that's for sure. Yeah.
You know, for all the jokes aside about cover bands, what role do you think they play in, I don't know if keeping music alive is like the correct, maybe overdramatic way to put it, but it's from different eras that not all audiences would be familiar with. If you're walking past someone who is a cover band or bringing these songs to various diverse audiences, depending on the venue, what role do you see cover bands playing? And why do you want to be in it, you know?
Yeah, well, two things on that. One is anybody under probably 40, they might not even know what I'm talking about, right? When I say a Joe Jackson cover band, they're like, Joe who? Michael Jackson's dad had a band? I'm like, no, wrong Joe, wrong Jackson. But yeah, so a lot of people don't know that music, but the people who do, it's an emotional attachment, right? You grow up, you come of age at a certain time and you fall in love with certain music, you know, certain albums and maybe a certain show that you saw, like, you know, your first five concerts of your life usually stick with you pretty hard, right? So you have those in your mind. And so if a band comes along and, you know, they're able to reproduce that or some level of that, it's fun to take your, you know, your wife or your girlfriend or boyfriend, you know, your friends to it and relive it and get that emotional attachment again. I think that's the key thing is just finding that love for music.
Well, Brian, it's been fun to talk about this world you're a part of. Thanks for taking the time.
Anytime. Thanks for having me.
Brian Wooldridge is the bassist and leader for Look Sharp, a local Joe Jackson tribute band. He joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, you can download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll hear from the new host of NPR's It's Been a Minute and talk about breaking down current events through pop culture. Plus, we'll learn about some of the many events happening this month in Milwaukee. That's all tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.